Bevor es losgeht, noch ein Hinweis. Es gibt zu dieser Folge ein Transkript in deutscher Sprache. Den Link dazu findet ihr in den Shownotes. Was macht Medizin und Forschung wirklich lebendig? Es sind nicht nur die Formeln im Labor oder die Studien auf dem Papier. Es sind die Menschen dahinter. Forscherinnen, die nach Lösungen suchen. Ärztinnen, die nicht Krankheiten behandeln, sondern den Menschen als Gesamtes sehen und gute Lebensmomente bewahren wollen. Und vor allem Betroffene. Der Vater, die Freundin. Menschen wie du und ich, deren Geschichten uns berühren und antreiben. Willkommen bei Wirkstoff Mensch, dem Podcast von Lilly. Hier hören wir zu, wir lernen und wir verstehen, was es heißt, wenn Wissenschaft auf Leben trifft. Mein Name ist Birgit Fenderl und dies ist unser Raum für Geschichten, die bewegen. Herzlich willkommen, geschätzte Hörerinnen und Hörer, und danke, dass ihr euch wieder für Wirkstoff Mensch entschieden habt. Heute erwartet euch eine ganz besondere Folge mit einem der weltweit führenden Alzheimer-Forscher, Dr. John Sims. Er ist Neurologe und leitender medizinischer Direktor bei Lilly und er engagiert sich seit Jahren für die Erforschung von Medikamenten, mit denen Alzheimer behandelt und im besten Fall geheilt werden kann. Heute nimmt er sich Zeit, um in diesem Podcast über seine Forschung zu erzählen. Ich freue mich auf ein spannendes Gespräch mit Dr. John Sims, der aus Indianapolis zugeschaltet ist, und deshalb geht es hier heute auf Englisch weiter. Welcome everybody to this special edition of Wirkstoff Mensch, and thank you for joining us. My name is Birgit Fenderl and today I'm welcoming one of the leading researchers in the field of Alzheimer's disease, Dr. John Sims. He is Associate Vice President at Eli Lilly & Company and he's the Head of Medical Development at the Neuroscience Business Unit. And he's joining us from Indianapolis today. So good morning, Dr. John Sims.
Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for taking time and joining us on this podcast. It's really a great pleasure having you with us here. And I'm looking forward to a really great talk to you. And I'm very happy that you can share your insight about your research with us. But if you don't mind, I would like to start a little bit more on a personal thing with you, because so our audience gets to know you a bit, if that's fine for you.
Yeah, sure. So I think, you know, the reason why I became a physician is a little bit of a complicated story. I actually originally wanted to be an astrophysicist. In fact, Carl Sagan was my superhero, but my stepfather, who was a psychologist, I think he thought maybe that was I should focus on the problems here on Earth rather than out in space. And so he gave me a book when I was in high school by an author called Michael Gazzaniga. And this was a book about some early surgeries that people had done where they had cut the brain in half for people who had intractable epilepsy. That was their only treatment back then.
Oh my God.
And it allowed them to start studying what the differences between the left brain and the right brain were. And I read that book and I'm like, okay, this is like really interesting, super fascinating. And it was just as much of a challenging area as astrophysics. And so that was really, that book alone was the reason why I decided to go into, originally it was going to be neurosurgery, but I eventually became a neurologist over time. So, but that was the real drive to this area.
That's very interesting. So what age was that when you read that book?
In high school. I was in high school.
Okay. Yeah. So quite young still.
Yeah.
And then where did you get your education?
So I grew up in the United States in Idaho. And then I went to Dartmouth Medical School, which is where Michael Gazzaniga was teaching. I thought, oh, this is going to be great. I'll get to interact with this person who's influenced me into going into neurosurgery. And as soon as I came to Dartmouth, he left and went to UC Davis. and so that's kind of what took me over to the East Coast of the United States. And then I stayed there for training for both for medical school. I did some research at Harvard and then did a residency at Harvard as well. And that's where I was there as on faculty staff before I came to Eli Lilly.
And with Eli Lilly for many years now, you're dedicating yourself to the research of Alzheimer's disease. It's an enormous and I think it's also a challenging task. So what motivated you to become so deeply involved in this field of research?
Well, so, you know, I've always been drawn to the unknown, which is part of the reason why I wanted to do astrophysics originally. And so I like hard problems. I like focusing on the things that are not known rather than spending time with the things that are known. And clearly, this is a disease where 99.9% of drug developments have all ended in failure when we started on this. And, you know, for a quarter of a century, nothing new had come about for helping the disease. And there was still nothing to kind of slow the disease down. So, you know, obviously a really good challenge. In addition, my grandmother, her daughter, her son, who's my father, have all died from Alzheimer's disease. So it's obviously got a very, you know, personal direction. It's almost certainly coming for me someday. It's just as it's coming for almost anyone who now lives into their 80s. It's become such a common disease.
But you're going to be the one who finds the medication, and then no longer this disease will be that frightening as it is now.
Well, it's a team effort, right? It takes a lot. It takes the entire globe to kind of help solve this disease. And you realize just how many people it takes to do some of these hard things.
And as we're getting older and older, so it's more and more people who are affected with this disease, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think the Queen of England used to write birthday cards to people who were, you know, over 100 years old. And it's now she's gotten to writing birthday cards in the thousands and thousands for people in England who are becoming older than 100 years old. So, yeah, we are living longer.
And she herself, she got quite old, so.
Yes, indeed.
So, if we get into the topic, when you talk about Alzheimer's disease, we are talking about brain health, right?
Yeah.
For us not being experts, could you explain us or could you tell us how well the human brain is understood today? What do we know?
So, you know, perhaps it's the most complicated thing in the universe that we know, right? It has many, many hidden secrets. But, you know, as I mentioned, in the 70s, we were starting to understand the structure of it. And with modern imaging, we could kind of understand, you know, how it was put together. However, it holds one of the most profound forces in nature, right? It's our consciousness, the nature of ourselves, kind of what makes us human, what makes me different than you. And, you know, we can transplant organs to one another and it doesn't really change ultimately who we are. But, you know, in a science fiction world, if you can imagine transplanting brains, it would completely change who you are. So it really is the essence of ourselves. And it's why Alzheimer's is so devastating because it really takes us away from ourselves.
And how much do we know how a general brain functions? What would you say?
Well, you know, I don't know if you remember when I was a kid growing up, we used to say that, you know, you didn't use 80% of your brain, right? Only 20% of it was used. And Einstein mm-hmm. used more than that or something. That's all now not really true. I mean, we use all parts of our brain. And we know where each little function kind of sits in the brain. Everything from where you think, where you talk, where you plan, where you remember things, how you see things. So we understand, again, its ultimate kind of structure. But there are this part of consciousness that is a complete still a mystery to us at this point in time.
But does consciousness play a role when it comes to the medication against the disease?
Well, it to some degree it does, right? If you think about you know, memory and knowing things and perspective, right? You lose a lot of that. So, I mean, yes, you're still conscious. And so, you know, it doesn't take that away until you die. But that idea of interacting with your world, you know, manipulating your world, engaging in that, in your world, that part starts to slowly disappear from the smallest things of just kind of not remembering that person that you should remember to not remembering how to cook a meal, to forgetting how to drive to the store that you've gone to all the time to pick up, you know, eggs and milk. And so it just starts eating away at that aspect of life that makes us all those things that we do, all your hobbies, the things you love to watch, your ability to read. Lots of people like to play games or cards with others, and you see all of that kind of deteriorate.
It's kind of everything.
Yeah, everything. Everything we are.
Yeah, everything we are. And the brain changes when somebody develops Alzheimer's disease. That's what you know. How does it change? What happens in the brain where this disease starts?
So what happens is that, because as we live longer, so starting in our 50s and 60s, our brain starts to build up a protein called beta amyloid. So this is a protein, and you can think of it really like cholesterol building up in your blood vessels. It's not a good thing to have build up, and it affects the organ. And as the brain starts building up this plaque, it starts to affect the neurons, which then they start dying, causes inflammation, and your ability to kind of remember things easily. So you start to need more, crutches to do complex tasks, like writing things down, reminders, forgetting to do things. Some people even start to withdraw from social events. They become fearful or anxious. In fact, depression and anxiety are very, very common in this disease. And part of it becomes, from fear and taboos, which I think, we can talk about later on, about just not being able to do well in your environment. So anyhow, as the neurons are starting to die, there's a part of your brain, it's called the hippocampus, which is Greek for seahorse. And that's because early pathologists thought it looked like a seahorse. Anyhow, this is a special place in your brain that stores your memories. It records them. And it allows you to go and retrieve them, kind of like a librarian getting a book for you off the shelf. And so as that part of the brain starts to die, you really can't remember where to put the book back on the shelf. And you certainly don't know what stack to go and get those books from. So this then requires all kinds of strategies for people to try to kind of cope with that problem. And I think one of the things that most people don't understand about Alzheimer's disease is they think, oh, this person's got great memory. They're telling me about, World War II, or they're telling me about the time that they went, on a long trip. But that's not the problem. The problem is all the new stuff. And they're not telling you about all the new stuff. They're not remembering the fact that they went to see a movie with you yesterday, or that they went to a concert, or talk about, what was happening in the news. It's all the new stuff that's not getting recorded, not getting stored, and can't be retrieved. The old stuff's pretty good. In fact, that's really well preserved, and that's the stuff that kind of goes last. It's like your spouse's name, your first child's name. But it starts eating away at the most recent stuff, and then goes all the way to the old stuff. And anyhow, it spreads across the brain. So it will start to get your vision, your language centers, so you have a hard time speaking. Then it goes to the front of your brain where you think about all the that's where you do a lot of planning, like how to make a meal, right? That you have to boil the water first before you put the pasta in, right? You have to crack the eggs before you put them
everyday
in.
Everyday life stuff.
Everyday life stuff. So all that planning, and there's a lot of planning that you just don't think about. You just take it for granted because it's just what your brain does very well. Those things start to go. And then last part of your brain that gets impacted here is the part that helps us walk, feed ourselves, dress ourselves, and even go to the bathroom appropriately. And so those are some of the last things. Yeah.
All those abilities that disappear step by step.
Step by step, yeah. And it just kind of works that way. It's a fairly common way it progresses over time.
But that's a lot, So why is it so difficult to intervene with a medication here?
Well, because our brain is so special and so critical to our survival, the body's developed all these special ways to protect it, make it a very special organ. So, it starts with being completely surrounded by some of the strongest bones in our body. And so that's made it very difficult to access that tissue and even understand what's happening mm-hmm. with the tissue. You can imagine you can do skin biopsies and you can look at the liver and all kinds of other organs, but the brain is extremely hard to get to. And so that is required special imaging techniques like CAT scans or MRIs. The other thing that has made it really, really challenging is it, because it's to be protected at the utmost reason, the blood vessels that feed the brain are very special blood vessels. And in fact, they don't let things into the brain that aren't planned or supposed to be there. So that means that medicines have a really hard time getting into the brain to the tissues where you might want to treat it. And so any time you design a medicine, it has to have a special chemistry just to achieve getting into the brain, let alone doing the thing you want it to do when it gets there. So it's a real challenging organ to find therapies for.
But that's what you're working for with your team. There are many things you're knowing now and you didn't know when you started. So what are the newer things you discovered in your research?
Well, you know, it's a humbling experience. Even when you think you've kind of figured it out and you think you've figured out some of the main stumbling blocks, you kind of still fail. And there are always gaps when we're doing these things. And some you think don't matter. And others are, you worry that they're the Achilles heel that will, bring about failure. But I think the key is not to not fail. It's to learn when you do fail, because the failure is essentially inevitable in many of the things that we do. And so to take that learning and then reapply it the next time to do it better than you did.
And never give up.
And never give up. That's right.
Usually on this podcast, I'm not alone here, but I'm sitting here with the host of the podcast, which is the managing director of Lilly Austria, Mario Haller. I think you know him. And we had already spoken about Lilly's commitment to Alzheimer's research here on the podcast. And he called perseverance a part of the company's DNA. Is this also a guiding principle in your work when you just told us that you always have to never give up and to start again?
In fact, it's definitely part of my own DNA. I think, success is about perseverance. There are many talented people out there. There are many brilliant people out there. But to me, those that succeed and change the world are those that focus on the task, stick with it. It's the hard stuff that's worth doing. And, I think that one of my favorite sayings of all time is comes from actually Thomas Edison, who says, I have not failed. I've just found 10,000 ways in which it doesn't work. And that's the key, right? To not let yourself beat you, but to find out how you can beat yourself, take it to the next level and learn each time. And that's all perseverance.
Yeah, I think so. all the things you just told us, and we know, and one point is, and we talked about this on the podcast as well, is an early diagnosis, which is so important. Why is it, from your point of view, so important? And how difficult is it at the other side to get an early diagnosis?
So this is both exciting and frustrating at the same time. So I think, with most diseases that we appreciate, it's easier to impact that disease the earlier you catch it. It's just like cancer. You want to catch cancer very early, as early as possible, because when you catch it very late, it's extremely hard. And Alzheimer's is no different than any other disease. Earlier we catch it, I think the bigger impact we can have. The challenge that we have is that the most frustrating thing I find is that it's one of the few organs that is not routinely tested for when you go see your doctor. We don't test your brain. We don't know what your baseline function is. And there have traditionally been no routine tests for your brain, how it looks and how it's functioning and whether it has any kind of problem building up in it. I think that's about to change.
That should be done.
That should be done. We are now reaching a tipping point where, we were a bit in a nihilistic loop where we didn't have anything to do to help you, which then meant, why should you look? So I don't look, which made it harder to find, therapies. And now we have some therapies, and that will help bring people, I think, bring awareness to realize that forgetfulness is not a normal aging. It's a sign of probably pathology and abnormal aging, to come to see your doctor, to talk to them about your memory, and to get a diagnosis as early as possible. Because again, it's easier to treat earlier rather than later.
So as you mentioned, cancer, I think it will be the same in the US like in Europe and Austria. There are countless screenings and early detection tests, and we're going to that. Do you think there should be preventive screening for Alzheimer's as well, routinely?
Yes. I think, I think the system will evolve. And I think there are a few ways to think about it if we kind of think about the future. So I mentioned my grandmother, her daughter, my father. Why did they all get Alzheimer's disease? Well, the short answer is there's certainly genetics involved in this disease. So I think one of the things that we don't do today is understand whether you have any risks for developing this disease. And we it's been very well established. There's a gene. It's called ApoE. It comes in three different types. It comes in a low risk, a medium risk, and a high risk. And we each get two copies of that. So some of us are carrying around two of these high risk genes, which means that we're like 16 times more likely to get Alzheimer's disease, and we're likely to get it even earlier. So, you can know about this today, or you certainly should start thinking about it as you become, in your 50s, because as I mentioned, this disease starts early, which is both a good thing and a hard thing, because it gives us some runway to find it and then maybe do something about it. So in your 50s and 60s, we should be thinking about, are we having risks that will put us at a higher chance of getting the disease? And now we're starting to have some blood tests, and we certainly have some brain imaging tests that will now allow us to actually see if that pathology and problem is starting to happen in an individual's brain. So I think we're on the edge of that.
And what kind of person too, when he gets the information that, okay, you are at a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease one day, what can somebody do?
Well, so there are a couple of medicines. There are some older medicines that help with the symptoms. So those are important, and they can help reduce some of the symptoms. But their challenge is that they don't really slow the disease down. And so very recently, we now have two medicines that have been approved and are available for people, certainly in the United States and elsewhere. And some of them are just starting in Europe as well. And these medicines actually attack that amyloid, that protein that's building up in the brain, and they help remove it. And they help slow down that disease. So that gives, ideally, people more time, which is what almost all of us want, is more time to do the things that we love, do those hobbies, engage with grandchildren, spend time with loved ones in a meaningful way. And so, we can't cure it at all, but we can certainly today slow it down and give people what we think is more time.
Can somebody prevent it by having a healthy lifestyle, for example?
That's been a key area of interest. So, I think getting quality sleep, getting regular exercise, a healthy diet. I think access to good healthcare is also important, treating your blood pressure and other diabetes and other things like that. Having strong social interactions and being mentally engaged. I think all of these can contribute to, they certainly already contribute to a better quality of life, and they may actually slow down the onset of the disease. But I'm certain that for the vast majority of us, of all of us, we'll need more than just those strategies to beat this disease. So, as I mentioned, we all carry some of these risk genes, and, the lifestyles usually lose out to powerful genes that we carry in our body. So, but they are important things to engage and do, I think.
And a good lifestyle is good anyhow.
Good for you.
That's right. It's not against everything.
Yeah.
There has been recent studies, I think they've been published in Nature, and they suggest a link between lithium and Alzheimer's disease. And I just, I read that this is a new hope also for a new therapy. What do you think?
My first thought is that this, if you remember, aluminum was also linked. People stopped using soda cans and drinking out of aluminum, things like that. I think right now that data is probably maybe promising, but like most avenues that we've discovered, they end up in blind alleys. So I think the things that we know very well, very appreciate that are driving the disease, there are many of these that are very well established with lots and lots of data. And we still need to actually target those things. And I think those have some of the more promise to deliver help for people.
We had some very touching conversations on this podcast with family members of people having Alzheimer's disease. And it's often said that Alzheimer's is a disease of the relatives too, because it's turning upside down the life of everybody. So how important are caregivers and friends and people around Alzheimer's disease people for your research?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked this question. So one thing that people do not appreciate is the challenge of actually doing these trials. It differs from almost all other medical trials that we do. And it is the fact that the partner is a key person in our trials. They contribute actual scores to how well the patient's doing or the participant is doing. And that's because you can't necessarily rely on the recall of the person taking the medicines. And so we always consent and use scales and test the partner. And so they are integral into doing our studies. And in fact, we could not do them without a good partner. And what makes it really hard is as that many of our people are elderly, and their partners are also elderly. So they also get sick, hospitalized, and in some cases, some of them die. And when any of this happens, it makes it hard to continue on with the person who's taking the medicine. So, it's another way to think about it is imagine if I was doing a headache migraine trial and I gave you the medicine, but asked your partner, okay, so how's her headache doing? Right? This is it.
This I understand is makes, your point. Yeah.
It makes it really hard because we do rely on an external person to kind of give some perspective on how they're performing.
You already mentioned a little bit also how society deals with people with dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And still, I don't know how it is at your place, but still here it's kind of taboo. You don't talk about it very often. So, and everybody who has to do with the disease would have a much easier life if you can talk about it more openly and you just can deal with it. So what could we do better dealing with people having this disease?
Well, cancer used to be the most feared disease. And we had kind of the terminology in the U.S., we had a war on cancer, right? And we talked a lot about it. We focused a lot of resources on it. Well, Alzheimer's disease has now become the most feared disease. Partly because it takes the very essence of who we are, and then it eventually will kill us. And so this taboo will need to be dealt with. And I think part of that will come with just an openness and increasing conversations like the one you're currently doing, right? Your podcast alone helps increase awareness of the challenges that this disease presents society. And, the taboo will slightly dissolve as we talk more about it. And I think, depression used to be a huge taboo disease. And as we had medicines and we found ways to help people, people were much more open to talking about, mood disorders. And I think we're even looking at trying to prevent the disease. And so if we can get to a place where people are not impaired in their thinking, but we're treating them so that they don't get the impairment, that will, I think, really reduce the taboo, because that'll mean, I'm at risk. It's kind of like taking a high blood pressure medicine. I'm taking it so I don't have a heart attack, so I don't have a stroke. So these medicines could help people take these medicines to keep them from not, losing their memories and being more functional. And as we get older, people are working much longer in life, and they're being much more engaged in doing things that, we didn't normally think about 100 years ago. So this will allow people to, who want to really stay engaged in society to do so, hopefully, if we have these treatments for prevention as well.
As you mentioned, medicine, I read somewhere that there are some medicines against Alzheimer's. Also, that's nothing which really can stop or cure this disease, but they are very expensive. Isn't that another point that once you find a good medication, it's going to be very expensive? And then the question is, who's going to have the access to this medication?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when we think about medicines, we try to think about what value they are bringing to patients and to society. And right now, it's Alzheimer's is the sixth leading cause of death in people over 65. So it's having a huge impact. So when we think about these costs and benefits to society, we think, you know, you can't just think about the one side of the coin, which is the cost, but we'll also kind of what kind of downstream benefits do we have? And that's an active area of discussion. What does it mean to actually slow this disease down? A lot of people don't have a good sense of that because these are very new, and to understand that many people are just now starting to engage in those conversations. But ultimately, medicines should bring some kind of value. And then what is that value worth? And ultimately, hopefully, people can align on what is good for society.
And I think that's also the aim or the dream of your research team, that one day we're really going to have this medicine and this medication which is going to cure or stop at least this disease. When is this going to be? I know it's a terrible question, but I have to ask.
I don't want to sound negative because I'm definitely hopeful. But when we think about the expectations, yes, we all would love a cure. But if we think about it in a more critical way, you know, we've had over a century of therapies, life-saving therapies for diabetes, insulin, Nobel Prize, totally changed the face of that disease. But yet, we still have yet not cured that disease or completely prevented it. So I do think, you know, a bit of caution is warranted. I think we will have over this next decade or two some great successes, and each of these successes will be able to slow the disease down, hopefully substantially. And I'm hoping also that we will have the ability to also prevent it in some people. And this will be a huge impact, I think. So I'm very optimistic about having a positive impact. I'm not so sure we're going to get to curative therapies anytime soon. There are lots of theoretical science fiction types of therapies that exist and could eventually come. I mentioned genes, the genes that put us at risk. We are, you know, actively working on gene therapies that someday you might be able to change that gene and make and reduce your risk of having the disease. So
that
there are
sounds
lots,
really a little bit like science fiction.
it is like science fiction, but these are probably becoming more of a reality. And I think I'm hopeful that in cardiovascular medicine, they went through kind of like two decades of discovery, and they found like four large classes of medications that really changed the course of heart attacks and strokes for many, many people. And I think we are just starting probably that path, and we're going to find a handful of medicines that together, they really will reduce the burden of the disease and perhaps, like I said, even prevent it.
And more awareness that this is somebody which can affect, yeah.
Yeah.
Each of everybody of us.
Everyone.
Everyone. Yep. So wonderful. Did I forget any important aspect we should talk about in this podcast?
I think, you know, one of the things that that as we have struggled to come up with therapies, one story that sits underneath all of that is the amazing success that we've had in getting diagnostics elevated. And so I do think, you know, we briefly touched upon it, but, you know, before 30 years ago, all we had was just symptoms. If you had symptoms and you were having problems thinking, you know, maybe it was Alzheimer's disease, then we had imaging and we could see the brain, and it was, you know, we mentioned neurons dying and could see the brain being affected, but that wasn't specific to Alzheimer's disease, but it was suggestive. But now we have at least two ways to image the brain that can see the pathology building up in people's brains. These are new. These will help change the way we think about the disease. And we've now leveraged those into blood tests, which I think are coming inevitably in the next, you know, 1 to 5 years or so. And these will also really, really lower the bar to people being able to find out if something is wrong with them that might be Alzheimer's disease. And so I think you know, being able to do a blood test versus going in for a fancy brain scan is ultimately a real dream for, I think, for physicians and for patients to be able to kind of know what's going on with them. And I think this is really the unsung success at this point in time for diagnostics. And so those, I think, are going to continue to evolve as well and help make this an easier challenge, even in primary care.
So it's a very optimistic outlook for further generations after us. So maybe they have both. They have a diagnosis and then they have therapy.
That's right. Yeah, that's the goal.
That's wonderful. So thank you very much for taking your time and sharing your experiences and insights of research with us. And I hope we can talk about this once person to person when you maybe come here to Vienna. And then That would be great. that would be a great honor.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your time and thanks for focusing on this disease. It's a real important one. Oh,
thank you so much for being with us on this podcast, Dr. Sims. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ja, herzlichen Dank, Dr. John Sims, einem der führenden Forscher in puncto Alzheimer-Krankheit, der auch sehr eindrücklich geschildert hat, wie schwierig es ist, gegen diese Krankheit ein Medikament zu entwickeln. Wenn die Forschung dann aber ein Medikament entwickelt hat, dann kommt es noch lange nicht zu uns in die Apotheke. Da ist noch ein langer und schwieriger und sehr genau kontrollierter Prozess der Zulassung dazwischen. Aber auch darum gibt es Mythen und Fakten. Einen weiteren Mythos haben wir gefunden. Den hörst du sicherlich nicht gerne, weil das Dinge sind, die man wahrscheinlich, wenn man in der Pharmaindustrie tätig ist, mit denen man immer wieder konfrontiert ist, die man immer wieder versucht zu entkräften, sie bleiben trotzdem. Wir klären das heute. Pharmaunternehmen erschummeln sich die Zulassung. Wo kommt das her?
Ja, das wüsste ich auch sehr gerne, weil ich kenne eigentlich keinen Bereich, wo so hohe wissenschaftliche Maßstäbe an Studien oder auch an Zulassungen geknüpft sind. Trotzdem gibt es, wie du richtig sagst, die einen, die sagen, die rechnen sich ihre Studien zurecht, damit das Medikament auch gut ausschaut. Und es gibt auf der anderen Seite, und das wird natürlich immer stärker auch in den letzten Jahren, ich glaube, da ist Österreich auch relativ weit vorn, diese allgemeine Wissenschaftsfeindlichkeit, wo Wissenschaft per se und wissenschaftliche Errungenschaften in Frage gestellt werden. Was man sicherlich sagen muss, es gibt bei den Medikamenten nie, dass es bei 100% wirkt oder bei 0% wirkt, sondern was wir eigentlich in Studien auch ermitteln, ist mehr oder weniger so ein Mittelwert, dass wir sagen können, mit welcher Wahrscheinlichkeit wird das Produkt bei 80% der Patienten funktionieren oder wird eine XY-prozentige Risikoreduktion erzielen. Also das sind natürlich hier Mittelwerte. Und über was natürlich gerne gesprochen wird, sind die extremen Ausreißer, wo bei einem die Wunderheilung war oder beim anderen die Katastrophe und die großen Nebenwirkungen. Das sind halt die Sachen, die auch immer gern besprochen werden. Aber man muss ganz ehrlich sagen, die klinische Prüfung, die Zulassung und dann auch die Weiterverfolgung des Medikamentes, es hört ja mit der Zulassung die Verpflichtung der pharmazeutischen Industrie nicht aufzuschauen, was macht das Medikament, ist extrem robust und extrem wissenschaftlich fundiert.
Jetzt gibt es sehr aufwendige und die dauern ja auch auf recht lang klinische Studienprogramme, bis eben dann ein Wirkstoff oder ein Medikament zugelassen wird. Wie konkret schaut das aus?
Ja, also die klinische Forschung unterteilt sich in der Regel in drei Abschnitte, also in die erste Phase, zweite Phase, dritte Phase. In der ersten Phase ist es so, dass man an gesunden Probanden einen Wirkstoff testet, um hier ein bisschen auch zu schauen, was macht der Wirkstoff im Körper, wie wird er aufgenommen, wie wird er ausgeschieden, gibt es wirklich ganz gravierende Sachen am Anfang. In dem Bereich circa 60% der Medikamente schaffen es dann in die Phase 2. In der Phase 2 ist es dann so, dass man es schon mit an Menschen testet, die Zielerkrankung haben. Da geht es da sehr viel darum zu sagen, was ist die richtige Dosierung? Erhöhe ich die Dosierung, wirkt es dann besser oder kaufe ich mir mehr Nebenwirkungen ein? Also das nennen wir so salopp formuliert in der pharmazeutischen Industrie, so die Dosisfindungsstudien. Aber hier sind im Faktor 10 mehr Patienten dann schon beteiligt. Da sprechen wir schon so um 500 bis 1000 in dem im Bereich. Und sollte hier das Medikament es durch diese Phase 2 schaffen, dann kommt es in die Phase 3. Die Phase 2 ist die, wo am meisten Ausfall der Produkte ist. Also nur 30% rund schaffen es dann auch in die Phase 3, weil in der Phase 3 wird es in einer sehr großen Kohorte an Menschen oder einer sehr großen Population an Menschen getestet, um eben dort wirklich rauszufinden, wie ist die Wirksamkeit, da sind wir wieder dann bei diesen Mittelwerten, die wir dann auch angesprochen haben, was sind die Nebenwirkungen. Also das ist dann wirklich die sogenannte Zulassungsstudie. basierend auf der wir dann um eine Zulassung bei den Zulassungsbehörden. Also jetzt nicht so, wenn die Phase 3 positiv ist, dass die Pharmaindustrie jetzt sagt, hey super, dann bringen wir es auf den Markt, sondern der nächste Schritt ist dann, ich muss mit meinen Daten zu einer Zulassungsbehörde. Das wird sehr stark dann evaluiert. Da gibt es Zulassungsbehörden in den USA, in Europa, sehr viele andere Länder, Japan oder auch Großbritannien haben ihre eigenen Zulassungsbehörden. Aber dort wird noch einmal sehr genau angeschaut, was ist der Kosten-Nutzen. Und wenn wir dann dort eine Zulassung bekommen, dann können wir das Produkt erst auf den Markt bringen. Und nach dieser Phase 3 gibt es sogenannte Phase 4 Studien, wo wir uns im täglichen Alltag auch weiter anschauen, was kann das Medikament, können wir noch spezifischer herausarbeiten, für welchen Patient, für welche Patientin es am besten geeignet ist. Und was wir auch machen müssen, und die Verpflichtung haben wir, kontinuierlich Nebenwirkungen zu monitorieren. Also es entsteht mehr oder weniger nach der Zulassung eine riesige Datenbank über den Lebenslauf des Moleküls, wo mehr oder weniger immer alle Daten, auch was Nebenwirkungen betrifft, erfasst werden. Das müssen wir innerhalb von 24 Stunden melden. Und da sieht man dann vielleicht auch, wenn es dann bei Millionen an Menschen angewendet wird, vielleicht auch Sachen, die man in den Studien noch nicht sieht. Hoffentlich nicht, aber gibt es natürlich auch diese Fälle. Und last but not least, glaube ich, was sehr wichtig ist hier in dem Bereich auch zu erwähnen, ist, dass wir auch die Verpflichtung haben, oft heißt es, und die negativen Studien lässt die Pharmaindustrie dann unter den Tisch fallen, dass wir volle Transparenzverpflichtung haben. Also jede negative Studie, sei es jetzt Phase 2, Phase 3, wo etwas negativ ausgegangen ist oder eine Nebenwirkung aufgetreten ist, keine Wirksamkeit, müssen wir offenlegen, was den Zweck hat, nicht nur um unser Gewissen reinzuwaschen, sondern der Zweck ist, wir wollen, dass alle Daten der Wissenschaft zur Verfügung gestellt werden, damit auch andere aus diesen Fehlern vielleicht lernen können oder auch aus diesen Datensätzen lernen können, damit das nächste Medikament, die nächste Studie noch besser aufgesetzt wird.
Und selbst wenn eure Studien alle erfolgreich waren, kann es sein, dass man hört, die Behörde sagt trotzdem Nein, weil die sehr streng ist. Also das heißt, erschummeln kann man sich die Zulassung auf den Markt keinesfalls.
Also ich wüsste nicht wie, wenn ich ehrlich bin. Also wenn ich mir all diese Regulativien hier anschaue, auch die klinischen Studien, das habe ich vielleicht vorher vergessen zu sagen, da unterliegen einem sehr, also die können nicht wir einfach machen, sondern die unterliegen einem sehr klaren Konzept. Da gibt es auch Prüforgane, die während dieser klinischen Studien mehr oder weniger prüfen, ob das den guten klinischen Praktiken unterliegt und alles auch in die Richtung gemacht wird. Also wenn man sich das alles betrachtet, dann erscheint es mir nicht möglich, dass man hier sich irgendwas erschummeln oder erschwindeln kann.
Damit hätten wir einen weiteren Mythos entzaubert. Danke dir.
Sehr gerne.
Jede Medizin hat eine Geschichte. Und heute haben wir wieder eine davon gehört. Eine Geschichte von Mut, von Hoffnung. Das war Wirkstoffmensch, der Podcast von Lilly. Schön, dass ihr mit dabei wart. Wenn euch diese Folge berührt hat, folgt uns gerne und empfehlt uns weiter, denn geteilte Geschichten wirken am stärksten. Gerne schreibt uns auch an presse-austria@lilly.com. Wir freuen uns auf den Austausch. Danke fürs Zuhören. Wir hören uns wieder bei Wirkstoffmensch. Bis dahin, passen Sie gut auf sich und andere auf.